Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell.
An address to the nation by the President concerning the enrollment of James Meredith at the University of Mississippi. From the President's office at the White House, September 30th, 1962.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. The orders of the court in the case of Meredith versus Fair are beginning to be carried out. Mr. James Meredith is now in residence on the campus of the University of Mississippi. This has been accomplished thus far without the use of National Guard or other troops, and it is to be hoped that the law enforcement officers of the state of Mississippi and the federal marshals will continue to be sufficient in the future. All students, members of the faculty, and public officials in both Mississippi and the nation will be able, it is hoped, to return to their normal activities with full confidence in the integrity of American law. This is as it should be, for our nation is founded on the principle that observance of the law is the eternal safeguard of liberty, and defiance of the law is the surest road to tyranny. The law which we obey includes the final rulings of the courts, as well as the enactment of our legislative bodies. Even among law-abiding men, few laws are universally loved, but they are uniformly respected and not resisted. Americans are free, in short, to disagree with the law, but not to disobey it. For in a government of laws and not of men, no man, however prominent or powerful, and no mob, however unruly or boisterous, is entitled to defy a court of law. If this country should ever reach the point where any man or group of men, by force or threat of force, could long deny the commands of our court and our Constitution, then no law would stand free from doubt. No judge would be sure of his writ, and no citizen would be safe from his neighbors. In this case, in which the United States government was not until recently involved, Mr. Meredith brought a private suit in federal court against those who were excluding him from the university. A series of federal courts, all the way to the Supreme Court, repeatedly ordered Mr. Meredith's admission to the university. When those orders were defied, and those who sought to implement them threatened with arrest and violence, the United States Court of Appeals, consisting of Chief Judge Tuttle of Georgia, Judge Hutchison of Texas, Judge Reeves of Alabama, Judge Jones of Florida, Judge Brown of Texas, Judge Wisdom of Louisiana, Judge Gerwin of Alabama, and Judge Bell of Georgia, made clear the fact that the enforcement of its order had become an obligation of the United States government. Even though this government had not originally been a party to the case, my responsibility as president was therefore inescapable. I accept it. My obligation under the Constitution and the statutes of the United States was and is to implement the orders of the court with whatever means are necessary and with as little force and civil disorder as the circumstances permit. It was for this reason that I federalized the Mississippi National Guard as the most appropriate instrument, should any be needed, to preserve law and order while United States Marshals carried out the orders of the court and prepared to back them up with whatever other civil or military enforcement might have been required. I deeply regret the fact that any action by the executive branch was necessary in this case, but all other avenues and alternatives, including persuasion and conciliation, had been tried and exhausted. Had the police powers of Mississippi been used to support the orders of the court, instead of deliberately and unlawfully blocking them, had the University of Mississippi fulfilled its standard of excellence by quietly admitting this applicant in conformity with what so many other southern state universities have done for so many years, a peaceable and sensible solution would have been possible without any federal intervention. This nation is proud of the many instances in which governors, educators, and everyday citizens from the South have shown to the world the gains that can be made by persuasion and goodwill in a society ruled by law. Specifically, I would like to take this occasion to express the thanks of this nation to those Southerners who have contributed to the progress of our democratic development in the entrance of students, regardless of race, to such great institutions as the state-supported universities of Virginia, North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Texas, Louisiana, Tennessee, Arkansas, and Kentucky. I recognize that the present period of transition and adjustment in our nation's Southland is a hard one for many people. Neither Mississippi nor any other southern state deserves to be charged with all the accumulated wrongs of the last 100 years of race relations. To the extent that there has been failure, the responsibility for that failure must be shared by us all, by every state, by every citizen. Mississippi and her university, moreover, are noted for their courage, for their contribution of talent and thought to the affairs of this nation. This is the state of Lucius Lamar and many others who have placed the national good ahead of sectional interest. This is the state which had 4 Medal of Honor winners in the Korean War alone. In fact, the Guard unit federalized this morning early is part of the 155th Infantry, one of the 10 oldest regiments in the Union, and one of the most decorated for sacrifice and bravery in 6 wars. In 1945, a Mississippi sergeant, Jake Lindsay, was honored by an unusual joint session of the Congress. I close, therefore, with this appeal to the students of the university, the people who are most concerned. You have a great tradition to uphold, a tradition of honor and courage, won on the field of battle and on the gridiron, as well as the university campus. You have a new opportunity to show that you are men of patriotism and integrity. For the most effective means of upholding the law is not the state policeman or the marshals or the National Guard. It is you. It lies in your courage to accept those laws with which you disagree, as well as those with which you agree. The eyes of the nation and all the world are upon you and upon all of us. And the honor of your university and state are in the balance. I am certain the great majority of the students will uphold that honor. There is, in short, no reason why the books on this case cannot now be quickly and quietly closed in the manner directed by the court. Let us preserve both the law and the peace. And then, healing those wounds that are within, we can turn to the greater crises that are without and stand united as one people in our pledge to man's freedom. Thank you and good night.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 219. And of course, it's a continuation of what we began in episode 217 and 218. I don't think there's any more explanation needed, so let's just get right back into it. And that'll leave us a little time at the end for a sandwich. So without further ado, let's listen to episode 219 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. Thank you. shortly after the president's proclamation, Secretary McNamara, through the secretaries of the Army and the Air Force, called all units and members of the Mississippi Army and Air National Guards into federal service for an indefinite period. At that time, McNamara directed Secretary Vance to take such action as might be necessary to carry out White House and Department of Defense orders and delegated authority to him to use regulars and the Guard. Transmitting the order to the proper Mississippi authorities, including Governor Barnett, he then instructed all Mississippi National Guard units to assemble at their home armories and air bases, where they would come under General Billingsley's operational control. Although news reports supplied a great deal of information on what was happening, most of the 9,894 Army and 1,017 Air Guardsmen called into service had no official knowledge of the specific duties they might be called upon to perform. On Sunday, over 92% nonetheless reported, which was, and I quote, a completely satisfactory response, according to the Adjutant General of the Mississippi National Guard, Major General William P. Wilson, with absolutely no incidents of any individual willfully refusing to report. The Guardsmen, Wilson added tartly, responded in the same manner as though they were mobilized for a real, and I say again, a real national emergency. An unusual case was that of the commanding general of the 31st Infantry Division Artillery, the senior commander of the Mississippi Army National Guard, Brigadier General Claude F. Clayton, receiving orders to report to the air station where he was to occupy a position outside the chain of command. Clayton notified higher authorities that he was a U.S. District Court judge in civilian life and therefore subject to a conflict of interest because any rioters arrested in Oxford or at the university would be tried in his court. He received an official release from duty before the day was out. Meanwhile, instructions went out to three Mississippi National Guard units to prepare to move from their armories to Oxford by ground transport on Monday morning, October 1, when Meredith was to attempt to register again and when trouble was expected. They were to carry only individual weapons. Their commanding officers were to report to General Billingsley at Memphis Naval Air Station a day early, by 2 o'clock on Sunday, September 30th. In all, the strength of the units totaled somewhat more than 3,000 officers and enlisted men. Also summoned was a small detachment of doctors and enlisted men, 50 persons together, from the 134th Surgical Hospital, which had only recently been released from active duty in response to an international crisis in Berlin. Billingsley conferred at the Naval Air Station with the commanders of the three units on Sunday afternoon. He laid out his instructions from the Department of the Army, and he explained the probable missions, and he provided everyone with orientation material his staff had prepared. Robert Kennedy participated in the conference by telephone. Whatever their private feelings may have been, the officers were cordial and responsive. The mix of civilian and military forces and the question of who was running the Oxford operation in Washington created problems for Billingsley. He served directly under the chief of staff and had instructions to aid the Department of Justice and now learned from Abrams that Attorney General Kennedy was exercising policy direction for the operation. Planning by the Departments of Justice and of the Army, however, had proceeded somewhat independently, which made coordination difficult when the need arose because of separate instructions from the two departments. This arrangement gave Kennedy greater responsibility for Oxford than Attorney General Brownell had exercised for Little Rock, and this made it especially important that the Department of Justice and the Army work in close coordination. Problems began to arise early Sunday afternoon. Without any prior warning, Abrams informed Billingsley that he would also have to command the federal marshals guarding Meredith, later relating that his military mind boggled at the sight of the marshals standing about in seeming disorder He was daunted by the additional mission. When Billingsley located Assistant Attorney General Oberdorfer, who had charge of the marshals, and began to express his dismay, Oberdorfer cut him short. "General," he reported to us, said, "there's just one thing we want to hear from you. What are your capabilities?" Shortly afterward, however, the marshals were removed from Billingsley's control. The elimination of one problem merely created another. Given Billingsley's mission to assist the marshals in restoring and maintaining order on the Oxford campus, it appeared that the general would answer to Deputy Attorney General Katzenbach, the senior Department of Justice official in Oxford, and, as Billingsley might have presumed, the president's representative at the scene. Becoming aware of the real need for coordination as the crisis in Oxford mounted Sunday evening, Katzenbach informed Vance that he would like to have a liaison officer from Billingsley's staff. Vance issued the necessary instructions, thus bridging an organizational and communications gap in the operation. Meanwhile, the Army representation at the scene increased. Serving as the personal representative of the Chief of Staff, General Abrams left Andrews Air Force Base, Maryland, at 10 o'clock Sunday morning. Included in his party were his legal advisor, Colonel Bland West of the Office of the Judge Advocate General, and a three-man team from the Office of the Chief of Information. At Memphis Naval Air Station, the information officer from Fort Benning and his party joined with Army Public Affairs officers already on the scene, under the command of Lieutenant Colonel L. Gordon Hill, to form the 13-man information section prescribed in earlier planning. The troops were also assembling. By Sunday afternoon, they were all variously en route, on alert, or already positioned at the Naval Air Station and the Tent City in Mississippi. There were 4,582 regular officers and enlisted men. The number included the personnel of the Marine Aircraft Group 26, which was at the Naval Air Station with its helicopters. In addition, three Mississippi National Guard units totaling 3,116 men had been alerted for possible movement to Oxford on Monday, when trouble was expected. Not included in these figures were the Air Force personnel involved in the airlift, the Army personnel who staffed the operation in Washington, and the support personnel and staff members employed by the headquarters of the Continental Army Command and by the numbered armies involved. Even as the marshals and troops readied themselves, the Kennedy administration made every possible effort, despite its previous experience with Barnett, to secure a guarantee of safe registration for Meredith. President Kennedy himself spoke twice with Barnett on Saturday before issuing his proclamation. In the first conversation, the governor had little to offer, but in the second, after rambling on about various diversionary measures that might allow Meredith to be registered, he had suggested a 3-week postponement to allow the situation to cool down. In the end, however, he had declined to guarantee Meredith's safety at the end of the period, effectively ending negotiations with the president. On Sunday morning, a worried Barnett had called Robert Kennedy to plead again for a postponement of Meredith's enrollment. When told that that was impossible, he made a new proposal. A large military force, he suggested, should escort Meredith to the campus. Barnett would meet him, backed by unarmed highway patrolmen, supported by unarmed sheriffs. And he would then read a proclamation barring Meredith. The federal military escort would then draw its weapons, and Barnett would then capitulate. Kennedy rejected the proposal out of hand, but countered with a suggestion that the marshals occupy the campus that day and that Meredith arrive by helicopter on Monday, October 1st. When Barnett hesitated, the attorney general threatened to have the president, during a television address to the nation that evening, reveal the record of Barnett's earlier bargaining with him and the fact that the governor lied. Hoping to prevent any revelation of the secret negotiations, Barnett capitulated with a suggestion that Kennedy have Meredith flown to the campus before the president's address. From then on, the discussion moved rapidly. Barnett gave assurances that the state police would give every assistance to federal officials. He received, in return, an agreement that he would be allowed to issue a statement saying that he had given way to superior force and that he would pursue the matter further in the courts. Under this agreement, the element of surprise favored the federal forces. But precisely how Barnett was to maintain the peace in the event of trouble was never spelled out. Robert Kennedy saw no need to alter the plans under which the Army would act, if needed, on Monday when Meredith was expected to arrive in Oxford to register. And he evidently saw no need to discuss the matter with the Army before deciding to move Meredith on Sunday. Instead, Kennedy simply told Secretary Vance around 2:30 Sunday that, and I quote, the plan was for the marshals to go it alone today. He did not want troops in Mississippi, he later explained, because that would have destroyed the whole idea of the marshals. As for the university, he also left it in the dark. Campus officials had hired extra police from nearby towns for Monday, when they expected Meredith to arrive, but only the regular policing staff was on hand for the weekend. They learned only just before 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon that Meredith would be arriving a day early. At that hour, truckloads of marshals began to pass by the residence of Chancellor John D. Williams on their way to the center of the campus. This contingent, 160 or 170 strong, was the first to reach Oxford from the Memphis staging area via the small University Oxford Airport that was just 2 miles away. These marshals, as well as those who followed, were under the immediate command of Chief U.S. Marshal McShane and his deputy, Marshal Cameron. Shortly afterward, Katzenbach arrived from Washington to take overall charge. 7 Army trucks, 4 of them driven by black soldiers, and a sedan from the 10th City were at the airport to meet Katzenbach's party and the marshals. Before reaching the campus, the convoy met by prearrangement with the head of the Mississippi State Police, Colonel Thomas B. Birdsong, who escorted it the rest of the way. Its destination was the Lyceum, the university's principal administrative building. Centrally located on campus, the Lyceum was on a tree-studded circle flanked on the northeast by a wooded area called the Grove. From the circle, opposite the Lyceum, University Avenue ran straight across Hillgard Cut and the Illinois Central Railroad tracks into the adjacent town of Oxford. Although several times enlarged since its opening in 1848, the Lyceum, with its stately classical columns, was the only survivor of the original university buildings and the most venerated structure on campus. It was there that Meredith would have to register the next day because university officials would not register him on Sunday. Katzenbach set up his command post in the registrar's office, using 2 open payphones in the hall as his telephone connections with the White House and the Department of Justice. He quickly secured the building by deploying the marshals around it. Notified that they were only on a drill, the marshals themselves wore varied clothing. Some sported T-shirts and other casual clothing, while others were dressed in business suits. All, however, possessed riot vests, identifying armbands, and white World War II helmet liners displaying the stencil words, U.S. Marshal. They carried gas masks, tear gas dispensers, riot batons, some homemade, and service revolvers out of sight in shoulder holsters. All had received at least some riot training. Highway patrolmen, sheriff's deputies, local policemen, and other peace officers formed a cordon between them and a gathering crowd. Assisting with the arrangements was the president pro temp of the Mississippi Senate, State Senator George M. Yarborough, who led a 4-man delegation dispatched to Oxford by Barnett to represent him personally and, I quote, to assure that the peace and security of the people of the state are fully protected. The members of the delegation apparently believed that they had been sent to Oxford to prepare once again to resist Meredith's enrollment at the university. But they found the federal marshals already present when they arrived. At the same time, Barnett had evidently instructed Birdsong to cooperate with the federal officials and keep order in accordance with his agreement. These layers of deception made for ambiguity, confusion, and considerable peril in a situation that would shortly begin to spin out of control. Although an airport crowd of 400 to 500 jeered and civilian vehicles darted recklessly in and out of the motor convoy en route, the first group of marshals reached the Lyceum without serious incident on Sunday afternoon, September 30th. After unloading, the trucks returned to the airport to pick up a second contingent. By that time, the group at the airport had started moving on foot toward the campus. When the trucks returned with more marshals, at about 5 o'clock that afternoon, a threatening crowd of 300 to 400 students already surrounded the Lyceum. The jeering continued, along with occasional shouts of "nigger" directed at four black truck drivers. Some state troopers on the scene attempted to maintain order, but others allowed the crowd to approach close enough to military vehicles to touch them, to yell insults through the windows. Meredith arrived in Oxford from the Memphis Naval Air Station about 5:30 Sunday. The atmosphere was tense. Escorted by the university police chief, highway patrolmen, and federal officials, his caravan drove slowly from the town's airport to the campus. He entered through a back entrance, and he proceeded uneventfully to Baxter Hall, a dormitory where he would live. Thanks to poor coordination between the Department of Justice and the Army, General Abrams first learned about Meredith's Sunday arrival from one of his staff members, who heard about it on a newscast while he was out getting something to eat. This, of course, was a surprising development, since Army planning had proceeded on the assumption that Meredith would not appear until Monday, when he was expected to register. According to Frederick C. Calhoun, the Marshal's official historian, there were 536 federal lawmen at Oxford, including 125 regular U.S. deputy marshals, 300 border patrolmen, and 97 prison guards sworn in as special deputy marshals. It has never been clear, however, despite Calhoun's figures, exactly how many of these lawmen were there that night. About 300 surrounded the Lyceum. Others guarded Meredith at Baxter Hall, and some apparently did not arrive until later. At 7:30 that evening, Governor Barnett went on television to announce that Meredith had arrived on campus under federal protection and to urge that peace be preserved. In a radio broadcast later that night, however, he denied that he had given in to the government's wishes. An ominous addendum. Heightening official concerns was a report that Major General Edwin A. Walker, U.S. Army retired, had come to Oxford and registered under an assumed name. The commander of federal troops at Little Rock, Walker had been compelled to retire from the Army for distributing right-wing propaganda to his troops. He had refused to fade away, however, and had made a radio appeal for 10,000 volunteers to come to Mississippi to, and I quote, rally to the cause of freedom. Secretary Vance instructed Abrams to ask the marshals to detain Walker if his actions made it necessary. Meanwhile, the crowd on the Oxford campus grew steadily, reaching 1,000 by early evening, and then increasing to 2,000 or more. Many were outsiders, some of whom came armed. They centered their hostility on the cordon of marshals around the Lyceum. But some also took notice of Baxter Hall once they learned that Meredith was there. At one point, the marshals protecting Meredith became so concerned that they shoved him into a closet and covered him with a mattress. The crowd's anger at this point was nonetheless directed primarily against the federal government and its intervention in what many considered the internal affairs of Mississippi. Among those drawn to the scene was Lieutenant Colonel Whitney D. Stewart, professor of military science at the university, who was accompanied by a young Army intelligence agent, one of a number drawn from the 111th Intelligence Corps, and assigned to Oxford to augment the one-man Oxford office. Stewart watched as rioters shouted obscenities at the marshals, spit at them, and threw bottles, bricks, lighted cigarette butts, and pieces of pipe and cinder blocks. A new science building under the construction near the circle on which the Lyceum stood provided a ready source of missiles. The president began his radio and television address at 8 o'clock, Oxford time, with an appeal to reason and with laudatory references to Mississippi's history. But his words had little effect. Many rioters listened to Kennedy on their transistor radios and then returned to throwing objects at the marshals. Thank you for listening to episode 219 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. And please do listen to episode 220, our continuation episode of James Meredith and the Oxford Riots.